Hey everyone, welcome back to the 443 Security Simplified. I'm your host, Mark the Liberty, and joining me today is...
DJ Corey Knockrunner! Woo woo woo!
And on today's episode, we are super excited because we have a special...
Because I'm a DJ!
Because Corey's a DJ, sorry.
I interrupted.
I was going to say because we have a internet security report that just came out, and we're devoting a whole episode to talk about
it. That's my first track, man.
Internet security.
Firebox report. Feed.
Let's jump to the news first, though. I can't handle this. All right, we have a short news story today because I don't want to pass up an opportunity to crap on Facebook.
Short but smelly.
Short,
but,
yeah. So just today, as we're recording this, Brian Krebs published some insight into a password issue at Facebook. He cited anonymous sources originally.
What, you forgot to change A to another.
Oh, yes. Another password issue at Facebook. They really are having a bit of a rough go. It couldn't happen to a better company.
Yeah, it was so sad.
So it turns out since 2012, I think the date was, they have been inadvertently logging passwords in plain text as people authenticate. To the order of, they said, hundreds of millions of Facebook Lite users. So Facebook Lite, I just learned about, is a stripped-down version of Facebook for certain countries where data caps are an issue. Hmm. So hundreds of millions of Facebook Lite users, tens of millions of normal Facebook users, and tens of thousands of Instagram users have potentially had their passwords logged in plain text. And now this is internal only. It's not like you or I could go in there and get access to these passwords.
And it sounds like it's somehow decoupled from like normally a website has a database mm-hmm. and there's a password, you know, table somewhere in there that's typically hashed. And it sounds like whatever they were doing internally, it's decoupled. That probably still exists for these users, but there's a clear text version somewhere else.
Yep. They said, though, that it's they were potentially accessible by up to 20,000 Facebook employees. They do have records of 2,000 engineers or developers have made 9 million queries to this data set since it's come into existence, but they haven't noted any actual abuse or so they're not forcing people to reset passwords, which is interesting. You'd think that, I mean, it's, even if it is just an internal breach, I'd still want to force people to reset passwords.
But maybe this news, by the way, I mean, if you're worried about a Facebook employee having your password, you're welcome to go change it now. It's probably a good idea.
True. So what do you think our next Facebook news story is going to be next week?
I don't know. That turns out they were colluding with Russia. It wasn't just hosting fake news.
I said news. All right. Let's move on to our main section then. For our main section today, it's time again. Our quarterly internet security report just came out. It would have been last week as you're Woo-hoo. Listening to this, which means we have another special internet security report edition of the 443 podcast. If you're not familiar with our security report, you can find it on watchguard.com/security-report, I believe. We put it out every quarter where we include stats from what we call the Firebox feed, which are is our threat intelligence feed from all of our fireboxes deployed across the world. And then some firsthand research that we do. And then we also hit a top news story as well and try and break it down to show exactly how these security issues.
Usually a little more tech detail in the story that you tend to get from a news article.
Exactly. This year was a whopper. I think it was like 47 pages on final count.
Yeah.
We do have a handy dandy infographic that goes along with it too, if you want just the 2-page summary.
Yeah. And besides the infographic, there is literally a 2-page executive summary as well.
Yep.
I'd say like my theme for this report is change, but this time not change in the threat landscape, but the fact that we're slowly adding new and interesting sections in the report, and I'm sure we'll talk about it now, but and we've added additional detail on some of the common sections we've had throughout the past few years.
Exactly. If you are someone that has read every single one of our previous reports since 2016,
I'm sure everyone is, right? I mean, that's got to be millions and millions of readers out there.
There's got to be some way we can
What's
prove it.
Was it published on the New York bestseller list for best security reports?
Yeah, definitely.
I think so.
Yes, that's a list that exists. Yes. So if you have read all of them, bravo.
Yeah.
If you haven't, you should definitely check this one out and all of our future ones as well as we continue to add more cool stuff to it. So with that, let's jump in with just some high-level stats out of it. This quarter, we had 42,000 appliances reporting in, which is higher than we've had previously. It keeps increasing, which is good. But it's still,
by the way, for the people looking at numbers, still a fraction of our real live boxes. This is an opt-in report. You know, you do have to opt into sharing this data with us. Again, we are not trying to get any personal data. We really only care about the threat hits and not your personal network or anything like that. The other thing to know is, even if you're willing to opt in, because we sell a hardware appliance, even though they're software versions, a lot of people tend to not be as up to date on firmware as they should, what we call here fireware. So if you're not running, I think it's 11.8.
Something like that.
If you're not running 11.8, you're just not participating. So there's lots of awesome features in the new firmware, let alone security updates and patches. So highly recommend you get above 12.
If you are a WatchGuard customer and you are running the latest firmware or something from the last 3 years, you can opt in. It's under Setup, Global Settings, or General Settings, depending on if you use WatchGuard System Manager or the web UI to configure it. It's just a little checkbox. There's a link to our docs that explain all the information that we call back in the telemetry, and it helps us put out these reports too, so please consider it.
Ultimately, it will make you more secure in that us watching this data also affects kind of our product and signature development and how we report things that we miss to our product team.
Exactly. So let's jump into the cool stats. This last quarter, in quarter four, we saw just over 11 million hits from our Gateway Antivirus Service, which is our signature-based anti-malware.
Yep, sounds like a lot, but actually kind of a decrease.
It
is. A surprising decrease considering the quarter it came in.
Yeah, it's down 28% quarter over quarter and 51% year over year. And you hinted at it, quarter four is usually the biggest quarter for malware.
Yeah, every year previous to this, it has been our highest malware quarter. We can't find a quantifiable reason, but our working theory has been, you know, the fourth quarter has lots of weird shopping seasons due to regional holidays, definitely Christmas, which is on everyone's list, but Thanksgiving, Black Friday, Cyber Monday, which have both kind of gone international now. So because of all that extra retail activity, there seems to be a lot of malware during that season.
And so this decrease means that we can safely assume that the attackers are stopping and we're all safe now, right?
Yeah, everything was perfect. They couldn't break into any POS systems, so they gave up.
No more malware.
I guess we're going to go out of business soon. Bummer.
Oh, darn.
Actually, it is, you know, we don't know exactly why it dropped in Q4. We expect it to continue to rise as a, you know, year-over-year trend. Nothing's going to stop in malware. But it is kind of an interesting little blip that I'm sure we'll be curious to see what happens as next quarter and next year comes into light.
So that was signature-based malware detections. That's only one of three anti-malware engines that we run on the Firebox. To jump ahead a little bit, we actually are including our data from our third signature or non-signature based anti-malware service in this report for the first time ever too.
Yep.
Intelligent AV, it's called, and it's machine learning and AI based, where we have a trained model running on the appliance that it can quickly run any potential payload through it and spit out a thumbs up or thumbs down on if it thinks it's malicious or not. This is the next step that any file processing goes through after these signature based detections. So if Gateway Antivirus potentially misses something, it goes on to Intelligent AV. And last quarter, we got just over 1 million hits from Intelligent AV, which is not bad considering how new it is too.
I would also say it's a lot. One little kind of inside baseball part of this particular service is it's actually a pretty resource intensive service. It uses some memory and some CPU. It has great benefits. The machine learning AI part means that it can catch some of the brand new malware, what we call zero-day malware that signatures don't catch, but it can catch it right away predictively, as opposed to our other service we'll talk about, which has to see it run and look at behaviors. So anyways, it's really great, but it is resource intensive. And unlike almost every other service we have on our Firebox platform, this one cannot run on our tabletops. This one needs a rack mounted device to have enough power to run. So for it to hit a million, I'm not going to give raw numbers, but tabletops are one of our best sellers because we have so many, you know, what we call distributed enterprises out there that might have a lot of remote locations. And while they love our rack mounts for their headquarters, they have tens, if not hundreds, of tabletops everywhere else. So throughout throughout the future of this service, you know, we're not going to have tabletop stats for this particular number. So just take that into context. Not only is a million great for being a brand new service, but that's a million on rack mount devices alone.
And to add some more context to that, we actually did run the numbers. And on appliances that reported in quarter four that had intelligent AV enabled, 23% of our total malware detections were caught by intelligent AV. So I, for one, find that amazing and fascinating, and it proves that, I mean, we may have fewer malware payloads coming through signature-based detections, but it shows that you need that additional layer to catch these other ones too.
And we didn't put it in the report, but that 23 number, what we didn't do is, we're going to be talking about APT Blocker in a second, which is our behavioral-based sandbox. It's what will almost always catch the most evasive malware, but it kind of comes last because there's cases where you have to submit a file and wait for the result. But we did a comparison. You know, in a second, we'll give you the raw APT numbers. But if you actually look at the comparison between Intelligent AV and APT Blocker together only on boxes that can run both, the early numbers that one of our security researchers shared with me was approximately 80% of the stuff that got past GAV was caught by Intelligent AV before the remaining trickle, you know, so only 20% of the missed stuff was getting to APT Blocker. So, you know, we were always catching all of that complete stuff with APT Blocker before, but now this Intelligent AV is catching a big majority of it immediately rather than having to wait for an APT Blocker result.
So machine learning AI, not just a buzzword?
No, it's definitely useful for some things. Anything that there's a big set of data of simple and easily understandable known bads and goods, it's pretty easy to get machine learning to be effective.
I like that qualification. It's good for some things.
Yeah. There are cases where there's too many attributes and there's a lot of complexity between what might be good, suspicious, or bad. And then machine learning acts more as a guide than a confidant. But for malware, it seems to be working very well.
So I probably shouldn't add AI to my blockchain pet business. No?
To give a real world example, like if we were looking at network anomaly detection with machine learning, I think machine learning could actually cut down the number of incidents you'd have to look at, but it wouldn't stop. It wouldn't be able to confidently say everything's bad or good. There'd still be stuff it would have to hand off to a human to figure out.
So
if that makes sense.
Yeah, a little. Clear as mud.
Clear as mud, thanks.
Yep. Our third anti-malware service that runs on it, we've mentioned it a few times, it's APT Blocker, where it uses actually a cloud-based sandbox in most cases to check true zero-day malware, as we call it. So malware payloads that we haven't seen before, runs it in the sandbox, watches behaviors, and then reports back if it's bad or good. In quarter four of 2018, it caught 3.8 million detections, which was a 7% increase quarter over quarter, which is even more impressive because Intelligent AV runs before it. So even with IAV catching so much stuff, we still saw even more zero-day malware.
Triply impressive because malware was down for the quarter overall, and yet APT Blocker was up. So that does suggest that that while there was less volume of malware, there was more evasive malware that took more proactive services. This is more anecdotal, but that could also suggest that rather than opportunistic attacks where people are just throwing the common crap against everyone, you know, maybe some of these are picking and choosing targets or picking and choosing, you know, more evasive threats against people.
Definitely possible. So one of the big percentage numbers that we track every single quarter is something we call the zero-day malware number that we've mentioned a few times now. And when we say zero day, we don't mean it's exploiting a zero day vulnerability, an unmatched vulnerability. We mean it's...
I did have a Twitter fight on this, you know, because zero day is used, if you use zero day by itself, it's actually very commonly meant as exploits, network service or client exploits.
So zero day malware, on the other hand, though, is malware that bypasses signature-based antivirus. It's malware where it doesn't have a signature to catch it because it's using some form of obfuscation, or it is just
It's either evasive, it's brand new, or it uses packing encrypting techniques that it might be a family that's known, but it somehow got past the signature that existed.
Yep. And for quarter four of 2018, our zero-day malware percentage was 36.9%, which was up from the previous quarter.
Yeah,
still not the highest we've seen.
No.
But it's, what, almost...
Wasn't it 25 or something like that before?
It was like 28 or something.
Yeah.
But more than a third of all malware that we detected in quarter four was zero-day malware.
Yeah.
Meaning if
this
you were
is
just
not
using,
unusual.
Yeah, it's not. And if you were using just signature-based anti-malware, you're missing that.
We've reached the mid-40s and even the high-40s once, and I feel like mid-30s is kind of our equilibrium number. I bet you if we averaged the past, what has it been, 2 3/4 years or
something like that,
it would be hovering right around this number.
And before we move on to the other malware stats, if you want to get in an argument with Corey over zero-day versus zero-day malware, his Twitter handle is @SecAdept.
Darn it. I got there before I could say Zorro. Although I'd argue you can check Wikipedia. We're not the only one that have used zero-day malware before. And no, I did not update the entry myself.
I just love Corey's glorious Twitter battles. Moving on to some more general malware stats. One of the things we track is the top 10 malware by volume quarter over quarter. We see a lot of the same threats returning every single quarter. Mimikatz.
I will say malware, that we definitely see a lot of the same things on the malware top 10, but malware seems to at least more consistently get one or two new things.
True.
Whereas we'll talk later about network attacks, and that seems to be boringly consistent.
Exactly. Malware-wise, though, top threat, yet again, was Mimikatz. Password theft, authentication, still a big issue.
What do you think about that? I mean, authentication is definitely a big issue, and Mimikatz is heavily leveraged in bad attacks. But I also am starting, you know, it's definitely used by researchers all the time. It's just in such large numbers, it's crazy.
My theory is that it's one of those things that you just add to any Trojan.
Yeah, it's kind of, I think you're right.
If you're going to infect a system, if you've already got a dropper loading stuff, you load up Mimikatz to try and steal password hashes.
And they even have modules that are essentially, it's not the default executable you would get off the GitHub right now, but it's a module that's essentially a binary version of that, ready to go for Metasploit and other exploit frameworks. So I think you're right. And most, you know, botnets nowadays are very module, and they have pieces of code that you've seen before in other attacks or hacking tools.
Load up Mimikatz, load up your crypto miner.
It's just surprising you wouldn't see something like Nmap as much. Granted, Nmap has been whitelisted a little more than Mimikatz because it has more obvious good uses.
Yep. Still interesting, though. Our number two hit, though, was brand new for the quarter. It shot up, like, I think it was like 1,000%.
By the way, I think it's kind
quarter.
Of brand new for ever this type of attack, which we'll talk about, ever showing up on the malware list specifically.
Yeah. So our number two threat was detected by signature-based antivirus, but it was really more of a phishing campaign.
Yeah.
The name of it was Trojan Phishing MH. And it matched a series of emails that were basically sextortion campaigns, as we call them.
Yep.
Where it actually had a huge number of individual hits, so individual hashes, because they were custom tailored per recipient.
Yeah, I mean, 99% of every single one of this email is probably the same, but they probably have a different name and either a different password, or in a second you'll hear that they do have some information about you that's believably true, and that's how they're trying to trick you into thinking they have more than they really do, and try to extort you for money, essentially.
Yeah, one of our researchers dove in pretty hard into this for the report itself, so I recommend checking it out. But at a high level, it seemed the attackers used a lot of the most recent, like, plain text password breaches that we've seen, in order to make it seem like they have malware running on your computer that stole your password. And so they created this email where it says, hey, I have this malware running on your computer. Here's one of your passwords to prove it. By the way, I've enabled your webcam and watched you while you've gone to pornography websites. Yeah. I'm going to share all these pictures with your friend and family if you don't send money to this Bitcoin address.
Yeah. Don't worry about it. It's all BS. By the way, if you want to know more about it, look up Sextortion Scam on Sexplicity. I actually did a video on this way back in July of last year, but it really seems to, I've been seeing it more in the news lately. It really seems to be taken off.
Seems it's an easy attack for the attackers. It's very low effort. You get an email address, get a password from a breach, and just fire off one of these templated emails.
I don't like these bad guys, but you have to respect it as a emotional and psychological lure, right? I mean, let's be honest, there are probably people that are in front of their computers doing things they're not happy to share with the world. So you can see how it really could be a strong guilt lure to get them to pay you some money.
And so, I think the Bitcoin address associated with most of the samples actually had a few thousand bucks in it worth of Bitcoin. That doesn't mean they were necessarily paid. It could be they were seeding it to make it anyone that investigated look like it was legitimate because other people
like what are they called, a busker, a road musician who puts a little money in his hat at the beginning to get more people to tip.
Exactly. Still an interesting attack. Also rounding out the top 10, there were two crypto miners in it this time. One that seemed to be another flavor of a standalone just binary crypto miner we've seen previously. And then Razzy, which was one of our top hits last quarter, or in quarter three rather, was still in the top 10 this quarter, down a bit from where it was. But still, two crypto miners, even with all the markets crashing, it's interesting we're still seeing them
up
there.
We didn't focus on as much on that. We don't think it's going to go away, though. You know, despite what you just said, you know, crypto miners are dropping, so it could or cryptocurrency value is dropping. But I think it will always be one of those background modules that they continue to keep just because they can.
Trying to remember what John McAfee's promise was. He said something along the lines of Bitcoin will reach $1 million a coin by the end of 2020 or he'll do something, and it sounded awful. I'm really curious what that something is now. I'm going to have to look that up because it doesn't look like Bitcoin is going to reach $1 million.
I like watching what John McAfee says for the lulls, but that's about it. I don't have much respect for him, despite the fact that he actually did a lot for the industry early on.
He is undeniably a very smart dude, but he's also an idiot.
Yeah, a smart dude, but a little eccentric is how I would put it.
There you go, eccentric, yes.
And that's being kind and tactful.
Please don't send your goons after me, Mr. McAfee. I respect you.
He'll just shoot you himself with a shotgun.
Allegedly. You know, you and I have never been convicted of murder, but not in the same way that John McAfee has never been convicted of murder.
Yep. Of course, you could say smart people just never get under investigation.
Back to the report. So a new section in the malware bit of our report was, so we've previously every quarter talked about the top malware by volume. And one thing we've added this quarter is the most widespread malware, as we're calling it. So these are malware attacks that have hit the highest percentage of firewalls out there across the world.
And I think it's in part what we noticed. I mean, oftentimes one of the top malware samples by volume may have hit a kind of small fraction of the overall 42,000 boxes we're talking about. So this probably gives you a much better example of what is more common to all the customers out there.
And having said that, our number one hit on this widespread malware one kind of makes sense. It's a crypto miner, and it's actually CoinHive, which affected the CoinHive, which affected 16.5% of all WatchGuard fireboxes that were reporting in.
This is the web-based one, right?
Back this is when, the JavaScript-based one.
Guy made JavaScript for Monero specifically just because its calculations are easier to do in a CPU rather than a dedicated GPU.
Exactly.
It's heavy math, floating point, or whatever.
So it's a JavaScript-based crypto miner that companies could run, quote-unquote, legitimately on their websites as another revenue stream since a lot of people like us are blocking ads left and right.
Yeah.
But actually, in other news from CoinHive, we mentioned it previously, they have shut down because it is just no longer profitable.
So
for
I actually think it's safe to say anytime you see CoinHive now, it's probably not legitimate. I mean, I guess there's still some sites.
Not legitimate. Very loosely defined, as if like the other one was legitimate.
You could argue it's at least legal. And at least a website that is doing it probably put it in its EULA or gave a pop-up. Granted, there's nothing holding, even though they're out of business, there's nothing holding back websites from still using the JavaScript.
Nope, exactly. And it was actually right after they came out with this whole business model, people basically stole their JavaScript and used it illegitimately finding like cross-site scripting
vulnerabilities. Injecting it in sites that didn't really want it or putting it on their own malicious sites.
Yep, exactly. Number two on the widespread malware list was something called Crixos. Which affected 13% of all of our appliances.
I'm glad you pronounced that, not me.
What did you, Crixos?
Crixos is probably what I'd go with.
Oh, whatever.
Only because of Crytek and my gaming.
All right. Can your computer play Crysis 3?
Definitely. Okay. Now it can. Ever since I got interest in PC VR.
I'm sticking with Crixos because I already said it.
There we go.
That's another JavaScript-based piece of malware, but this one's actually Scareware, where when you go to a website that's running Crixos, it'll pop up a bunch of pop-ups saying that, oh, it's Microsoft and we've detected malware on your system. Call this support number right now to help get it fixed. This has been around for quite some time. Like, I remember encountering stuff like this, like FBI Scareware when I was like 8 going
long
across
time
the internet.
Ago. Yeah. Although FBI's Scareware's been around. The Microsoft twist. The first time I saw it being Microsoft, it was actually not in a pop-up computer-based malware. It was a vishing call. Mm-hmm. So it is very common that someone will randomly call you, probably using a dialer and only picking up when they detect a human, and saying, oh, I'm from Microsoft and doing this. But yeah, I remember the same Scarewares. I remember there is one that would, even if you have a webcam, it would turn it on and in the FBI warning, it like pretended it was a mugshot of you. And
that would scare little old me like to death.
I'm sure criminals would have loved if that were real, though, because if the FBI contacted you and said, for $500, I'll forgive all your crimes.
Right.
I mean, come on. Who believed that?
This Crixos actually was pretty annoying to deal with, though. It made it really difficult to get out of the pages that were hosting it. Like, it would mess with your mouse input. I think it put like an image overlay on it. It's like trick.
So if you clicked on the X, it wasn't really the X and it wouldn't close or something like that.
Tons of pop-ups. So still, I mean, in this case, just, you know, control X out of the window and you're pretty safe.
Task manager.
Yep. And I do want to make the point that Microsoft will never contact you to let you know you have
By the
a
way,
virus.
Most, I think almost every company will say they're not going to call or email you and for malware and that kind of thing.
Yep. The rest of the top most widespread malware list, there was an Office exploit, a code injector. There was another phishing-based attack, this one using Wells Fargo, I think.
Yeah, a banking one. Wells.
Yeah, which we dove into that one specifically in the report, too. So
I think you see the email even.
Yep, definitely check that out. When it comes to the regional breakdown of malware from the last quarter, we saw a return to what I'd call our normal trends, where the two quarters previous, APAC, the Asia region, was number one or very high up there in terms of malware volume, and it's way back down to last place again. It was EMEA, so Europe, Middle East, Africa had 47%. The Americas had 35% of the malware we saw, and APAC was down to just 17.5%, which is close to where we've seen it previously.
So this is normal for like anything beyond 2018. All the reports before, EMEA, America, APAC was always the order, and APAC was always third. But like you said, it was only the last two or three quarters. It was before Q4 that APAC suddenly started this rise. And by the way, it's interesting. I believe in Q3, we mentioned how Razzie, that Trojan that added crypto mining functionality, was huge in Q3. It was almost exclusively in APAC. And while it was still on the list, it's dropped quite a bit, as APAC has.
And I think now we're seeing Razzie spread across multiple different regions now.
Absolutely.
Too,
it's not just affecting one place.
Yep. So that's it for malware. Another section we keep track of is our network attack sections, which is our intrusion prevention service, another signature-based service looking for network-based attacks, so exploiting vulnerabilities on systems, services, web browsers, things like that.
So this could be a network server, or some sort of incoming network connection to one of the next network services you host, but it also can be all the client software that your users use to connect to the internet, and this little in-between, which is the web apps, you know, kind of the middleware of something running on a web server that can be vulnerable as well. Yep. IPS can catch all those types of attacks.
And we saw network-based attacks spike really hard towards the end of, I think, 2017 and into the beginning of 2018. But they've actually come back down now, and they're only just slowly starting to go back up again. I actually can't remember the exact number for our network attack hits, but it was,
I think it was a bit over a million, if I remember right.
It's up from quarter three, slightly up from quarter two of last year. So,
yeah, but not in the range where it really spiked for a few quarters ago. But this is another place we added something kind of new.
Yep.
You might have heard us allude to the fact that Both Top 10 on Malware and IPS has some regularity, but Malware seems to have a little bit of difference every quarter. IPS has been almost the same things, and even when occasionally one thing pops up that's different from the quarter, it's something we saw two quarters ago or something. So there's been very little truly new stuff in it, although, as you'll see, some does happen. So one of the things we did this year was added something called we looked at unique signatures, meaning now we're not just looking at the top 10 in volume, but of all the exploits out there, are they exploiting a lot of different exploits, or are they just exploiting kind of a few of the regular ones? And one of the unique things this quarter was we actually saw the most, the highest unique exploits number we've seen ever before, with 1,279 different exploits.
And that was twice as high as the previous highest one, which was quarter two of 2018.
Yeah, which was only what, you know, 600 or so.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, the second highest. It goes even lower. So while our top 10 did look semi-similar to the past top 10s, they seem to be exploiting a wider variety of network vulnerabilities.
Exactly. And when it came to the top 10, the only real new one was a Cisco WebEx vulnerability. It was actually kind of interesting, where it would look for a magic, if you had a magic string, so a sequence of letters and numbers on a web page, you could trigger the WebEx web browser extension to launch the desktop client, which would then allow you to communicate
pretty
with
much
it,
do anything,
pass command injection basically, and run whatever you want on the computer.
By the way, in the real world, me and Mark would consider this an old vulnerability because it was patched in 2017. But actually, in the context of IPS, a lot of the most common network attacks we see are dirt old, are like from, you know, the 2000s, even before the 10s. So 2017, while it is still old and patched, it's kind of newish compared to some of the other top 10.
Yep, exactly. So moving on to the research section of our report, where this quarter, one of our researchers went through and analyzed ExoBot, which was a banking Trojan from 2016 that targeted Android devices. I cannot do justice the amount of work he put into this in just this short little podcast, so check out the report. But he dives into what the Trojan is, what it does. It does overlay attacks against a whole bunch of different Android applications to try and steal credentials. He went through the whole backend system, which was fascinating. It was basically like a full cloud application.
Yeah.
Multi-tenancy, you could set up customers as the bad guy, set up customers that you're leasing out space to for this botnet. Really fascinating stuff in the report.
And just to let you know, I mean, what's interesting about this type of analysis is it was a source code analysis. You know, a lot of malware analysis you see is black box binary analysis, where obviously you can figure out what the malware is doing on the system, but you don't know a lot about the back end. You don't know about how well their programming skills are, how organized things are. You know, sometimes the source code can contain a module, but they don't have to add that module to the final bot client. So you can also find additional modules you may not have seen in one specific payload. So there's just so much deeper understanding you can get from doing a source code analysis. And of course, you get to get a deep dive. You know, doing a malware analysis of a bot client doesn't show you what the command line, the command and control interface looks like from a bad guy perspective. So definitely highly recommend you go look at it. It's similar to, I think, back in 2007 when ZBot was big. We've done source code analysis before, but this was on normal Windows botnets. So I found this Android one very fascinating. Great job by one of our researchers, Emil.
Yep. And then our final section for the report is what we call the top security incident for the quarter. And this quarter, we focused on something that we've actually talked about on this podcast a few times now, I think, which was the BGP incident involving Google and Cloudflare too, back in November, where a Nigerian ISP accidentally leaked some routing information and caused the majority of Google traffic for like 74 minutes to get routed through China, Russia, and down to Nigeria.
I didn't know big goddarn puppies were associated with routing.
Big goddarn puppies. Oh, is that
That's
the hint
BGP
for Mark?
Is,
what does
right?
BGP
no,
mean?
I'm just kidding. You don't have to define it. I've made you define it on like four podcasts before. So listeners, if you don't know what BGP is, go listen.
Big goddarn puppies. So throughout this section of the report, we walk through an overview of what BGP is. If you're not familiar with it.
Yeah, you'll know after the report.
Yep. Talked about exactly what happened here. It was an accident. Google and Cloudflare are backing it up. There was an accident, a misconfiguration by this one small ISP, but it still had some pretty big fallout and some pretty big ramifications where this one accident took down the largest internet organization in the world for a considerable amount of time. And imagine what would happen if there was a legitimate coordinated attack similar to this.
And I will say, by the way, the threat and news research part of it was great. But Mark, you wrote a lot of this section. So while we've mentioned BGP on the episode, if you really want to understand details about ASNs and IP prefixes and how BGP really works and kind of the cooperation that has to go on between ISPs, and it's a great read simply to get the BGP overview.
Thank you. I know it's a great section.
This guy definitely doesn't lack confidence.
No,
how
was
can
actually...
that beanie keep your huge head encapsulated? It's impressive.
It
it's like magic fabric.
I actually really enjoyed writing this one section, though, because it was cool digging into a rather complex protocol and an issue that a lot of people probably haven't heard of.
Yeah.
It didn't really make a whole lot of news.
And by the way, that should get to our talking points, too. I mean, the other thing you mentioned is some extensions to BGP that are surprisingly underused.
Exactly. So there are fixes for this issue that occurred. There's something called Route Public Key Infrastructure, or RPKI, where when an ISP advertises what IP addresses it owns out there to the internet, they can validate that using cryptography, very similar to how like HTTPS works on websites. But only 12.77% of prefixes out there on the internet were using RPKI.
Yeah.
And even worse, the portion of this that validates all that, route origin validation, less than 1% of autonomous systems on the internet, so these ISP routing systems, were validating these records.
Yep.
So there's fixes out there. We just need our ISPs to actually follow along.
It's kind of interesting, by the way. This seems to be the general evolution of the internet. Back when the internet gods wrote the first, RFP or RFCs for different...
Al Gore, right? He invented the internet, right?
The intertubes, I think, as they're properly called, thanks to Al Gore. But yes, I mean, back when they first designed all these standards, they were like very open and not very, they didn't validate, encrypt, or secure on purpose, right? If you think about when this was starting, they're trying to grow this into a system everyone can use. So openness was a big thing. That's why 10 years ago, the web was a encryptionless, validationless disaster. And then we had a kind of add TLS SSL or SSL TLS to web and email to add some validation. This is BGP and even DNS, the same story there, all of them going through extensions to these originally designed protocols that were made, kind of in this kind of good, assuming everyone's a good guy, community standard. By the way, there's recently like an interview with the guy that made the World Wide Web protocol.
Al Gore.
30 years later, not Al Gore. Okay. And he's basically talking about how the internet is the horrible Wild West today and not the way they imagined it. And yet they, it's in part because we started with these open protocols and didn't consider the security and validation implications until later. So now we're having to do duct tape and band-aids.
It's good that we're at least trying to do the duct tape and band-aids now, though.
Although 1% of BGP users are.
Trying, yes. Trying with a very loosely defined definition of trying. So takeaways for the full report, I think we have like 4 in total there, but some of the trends that we followed on there, phishing was another big trend for this quarter.
I like this because we've been talking about phishing forever, and we think it's actually one of the biggest attack surfaces that bad guys use, whether it's just in normal phishing to get you to click on malware, or whether it's used as a spearfish that turns into the kind of root cause of a total network compromise. Phishing's big, but because our report is mostly looking at malware and network exploits, not necessarily email, this was the first time we've had the opportunity to talk about it because it showed up due to malware prevention.
Yep, and we are going to focus more on phishing in future reports too. We've got our service DNS Watch, which is designed to help protect against phishes where we can actually block DNS requests from these potentially malicious emails. So we've got stats from that we're in the process of curating and hopefully adding to the next report. So keep an eye out for more phishing stats as well.
Definitely use Total Security to block the stuff we can block, but me and Mark both believe strongly in security awareness training. And by the way, some of our products, like the one you mentioned, DNS Watch, a core thing is, you know, DNS Watch is going to technologically defang phishing links so that even if your users click on them, they won't get infected, hopefully. But it also helps in training as it will give you immediate, you know, time of action training in a little video that they'll get if they do click on a link.
There's even some games, too, that they might get to play.
Yeah.
How to spot the fish games.
Yep.
Very useful. We don't like shaming our users when it comes to clicking fishes, but giving a little education so that hopefully they don't do it again actually goes a long way.
Long way. It's not going to remove all the incidents, but if you can drop your incidents from 20% to 2%,
that's a big improvement.
Yeah.
Another takeaway from the report, mobile app security. So following along with the banking Trojan, and that a lot of the times these applications are, they take advantage of people that are using less than legitimate ways to get apps on their phone. We call it sideloading. On Android, it's allowing apps from untrusted sources where maybe you want to get Pokemon Go a week before it comes out in your region.
Yeah.
And that's a way you can get malware on your phone.
A little harder on iOS, but they have jailbreaking. And once you're jailbroken, you can sideload apps just the same way.
So always be suspicious when installing an app from an untrusted source. I highly recommend against it unless you know exactly what you're doing.
I enable sideloading because I like doing some developer mode stuff. And if you're trying to make your own APK or play with stuff, you need to do it to load something that's not like signed by whatever marketplace. But
if you see a link for like Mario Run, don't go download it from there.
If it's free, there's a reason it's free.
Exactly. And then also just malware protection in general, I think, is another important takeaway. Like we saw that 37% of all malware was zero-day malware.
Yep.
So even more important than ever.
You need more advanced malware protection. I'd say none of our listeners have to worry about that because they probably have our products with Total Security and they have three layers of advanced protection.
Don't say unhackable.
Good to go. I won't say unhackable. That's what I learned from Oracle's Unbreakable.
Oh my goodness. Yes. So that's it for our overview of the report. There's much more detail than what we just glossed over throughout the rest of it. It is 47 pages, so pick your favorite parts and read them or check out the executive summary that we put out. If you have any questions on it, you can obviously reach out
to us. Send it to your friends, tweet it, put it on Facebook, tell your mom. I'm sure your mom loves to read about Exobot analysis.
I don't think my mom even knows what I do.
What are you talking about? My mom's in IDA Pro every day, reversing her favorite cooking app.
And again, if you want to yell at Corey on Twitter, his handle is SecAdept. Please.
Watch out. My Twitter war skills are on fleek.
Thanks for listening, guys. Hey, everyone. Thanks again for listening. As always, if you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. You can find me on Twitter at @XORRO_ and Corey on Twitter at @SecAdept.
And if you want to share your favorite brony fan fiction, make sure to tweet at @XORRO_.
Or check out Corey's sweet mixtape on SoundCloud as well. Thanks again for listening, guys, and we will see you next week.